Hello, I'm John Waters, and I'm supposed to announce there is no smoking in this theater, which I think is one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard of in my life. How can anyone sit through a length of a film, and especially a European film, and not have a cigarette? But don't you wish you had one right now? And I'm telling you, smoke anyway. It gives ushers jobs. And if people didn't smoke, there would be no employment for the youth of today. So once again, no smoking in this theater.
Because I had tweeted about this a while back, but I did want, I had a Adidas a full body top and bottom tracksuit,
yeah,
saved in my, you know, my notes app that I use, and I went back there, you know, after, you know, a paycheck hit, and I was like, oh, I don't have as many bills or whatever, and I went to go look at it, gone, just not, and not
oh,
only
no.
is it gone,
what,
but all the Adidas website devoid of good tracksuits right now. I don't know if it's a seasonal thing. I don't know if Adidas is getting out of the tracksuit game, but they're the brand I think of when I think of tracksuits.
Sure,
like,
yeah,
Adidas,
of course.
Full body, full green, or like full, you know.
No, it's got to
like
be full blue, right?
I want the burgundy. I want a burgundy
sure.
tracksuit.
No,
so
that's
bad.
Very good.
The burgundy
yeah.
thing,
with one of these
it's
white
like,
mesh tank tops,
I mean,
my
yes,
chain that
yes,
I'm getting.
But, I mean, I think it's kind of like the Star
Absolutely.
Trek thing, where if you're wearing that color of tracksuit, it means like you either have
yeah.
or imminently intend to kill somebody. I think.
No, I mean, like he's 100% going to be killed by mistake by the Russian mob.
Oh, I'm buying a gun. For
that's
sure.
what he. That's
and
what
then
he
not
wants.
Using it.
And also,
yes.
like, listen, Aaron. Like, I know that you're disappointed that it didn't happen for you this time, but I wouldn't worry too much about it because rivers always reach the sea. You know, it's your destiny. Your entire life has been leading toward you buying a full sweatsuit or tracksuit. And a gold chain, and like nothing is going to stop that from happening. I have utmost confidence in you.
Thank you, Harry. A full body tracksuit, a chain,
you've been
and
off
a chain. Gun.
You are
really
drunk.
Turned my
gun.
Life around. That would fix everything.
You've already got the hair. You've already got the sunglasses. Yeah.
You know, no one could tell me anything, and then I just die immediately.
Just a
someone,
looking like
a Russian
Grand Theft Auto 4 character.
yeah,
exactly.
Someone is lowering my body into a wood chipper as I'm saying this, and then yeah. Anyway.
I'm going to be
the episode now.
Kind of bummer.
I suppose.
Everybody,
or whatever.
Could everybody hear Aaron and me too?
I think that was it.
Oh, we don't have to do the episode either if we don't want to.
Hit
is
it.
Jason muted? Oh, Jason's hello. Microphone maybe not working. Jason, say something.
Oh,
Jason just dropped
we
out.
We just no, lost him. I thought
well,
he was
I'll
doing
do a snack
bit.
Report. Oh no, he's back. Okay,
I wasn't doing a fucking. Can everybody hear me now?
Yeah, I thought you were doing a bit.
Fucking, no, Aaron was talking and gesticulating and being very happy and like very very charismatic. And I was like, I can't hear you. And Aaron,
let's not
like,
go too
yeah,
far.
Yeah, like a Grand Theft Auto 4 character. Yeah, you got everything. And I'm like, is he just riffing without Aaron? Is he making fun of him because it looked like his microphone was off? This is the most impromptu, inconsiderate starting of an episode that we've had in many a year, but I do appreciate that we've actually.
So wait, were you not hearing Aaron at all during
not
that?
Not at all. His mic, his little mic thing was muted off. I was pretty sure he made a fuck up, so I said, "Hey man, we can't hear you." But you,
oh,
but
I could
you
hear him
were,
the whole time.
I was letting out
yeah.
solid 6 out of 10 bits there. I mean, some
yeah,
real,
we were really riffing.
I
in
really
the way that
riffing in a very unfunny
true
manner.
Blue Sunday
only
bits.
A local podcast with almost 200 followers could.
Listen, one of these days. You remember when we had more followers than episodes for a very, very, very short time?
Yeah. Those were the days, huh?
Those were the days.
The problem is we keep making so goddamn many of these fucking things. I
Joe Rogan said down. The same thing.
Here
you know?
We are on Easter Sunday.
Easter
but just
Sunday.
So committed to it that even though we've been, you know, drinking and it's Easter Sunday, here we are, you know?
Here we are on Easter Sunday. It's the end of March. It's Easter Sunday. It's Trans Day of Visibility. It's a lot of things for a lot of people. So we appreciate that you've spent at least a few minutes.
She is risen. You know what I mean? More like she is risen.
Thanks for listening to
Tri-Lord. Happy listening to those of you who are hearing this on Tuesday. Please go ahead, Jason.
It is a literal roundtable podcast. You can roll it away like a stone. We talk about movies that we saw or people we met at the Trilon Cinema in Minneapolis, Minnesota. You can find us on Twitter at Trilove Podcast. You can find the Trilon itself at trilon.org. My name is Jason Daphnis. I'm going to be killed responsibly on horseback as a compliment to the cavalry. You can find me on Twitter at Nintendoofus.
I regret the interruption. I'm Cody Narveson, and you can find me on Blue Sky at Cody Narveson.
We came here to kill each other. My name is Harry Mackin, and you can find me on Twitter at Punishtake.
My name is Aaron, and I am 92% sure I could have won all the duels in this film. Pretty sure. You can find me on Twitter at RB Please.
The French had brittle bones back then. All you had to do was really give them a stiff push.
They also, thin swords. Those swords, that's not a problem. I'm bringing a normal sword. I'm bringing a fucking
give me a baseball bat.
Conan I'm beating any saber shit.
That gets tossed at me.
You're bringing a like a cleaver, like a square I'm a claymore. Sword. Jesus
I'm bringing
Christ.
A fucking Zweihander. You know what I mean? I'm fucking decapitating Harvey
He's
Keitel.
An ultra great
sword. Or Keith Carradine, whichever you like.
Whoever's fool enough to get in my
Both
way.
Both of them at the same time, not a problem.
You would spend a lot of XP doing that. You would get one good shot. You better make it fucking count. This movie
you don't spend XP, Jason.
In
you
real
get
life,
it for
I mean,
defeating your
that's
enemies.
How I see it. Yeah. Thank you so much for joining. It's going to be an episode about a movie that played as a part of a series on actor Harvey Keitel, who stars in this film. It's called The Simmering Fury of Harvey Keitel. I think the series is over now, but we really wanted to cover this one, get a little bit of dip our toes into the Keitel waters a little bit. So you can check out more cool programming at the Trilon at trilon.org. We've got a running calendar there. We'll point you there in the show notes. But for right now, I actually want Aaron to introduce the movie that we're discussing. Which he always does by, I don't know, bringing out his key catch. What was it again? It's long and convoluted, and I never quite remember exactly how it goes. I always butcher it. So, Aaron, do you mind?
Yes, indeed, folks.
Thank you.
Didn't hear the drop on that one. I don't know if you're...
No, we didn't get that, Jason.
Just edit that
one
in later.
Oh, my God, come
maybe.
On. You got to be kidding me. No. Sons
what's,
of bitches.
What's going on?
I have no idea.
Or your shit. I mean, look,
it's because we didn't do this at 10 a.m. like usual.
I think it's because God is angry with us for doing
podcasts on his
the least holy
birthday.
Of things on this, the most holy of days.
Well...
Yes, indeed, folks.
Holy shit, dude.
Thank you. The Duelists, 1977 film directed by Sir Ridley Scott. The film was Scott's first, it was his debut feature film. It was very closely based on Joseph Conrad's 1908 short story slash kind of novella in the middle there, The Duel. The film follows two hussars, members of the French Light Cavalry. You know, they fight with swords, they fight with guns, they fight on horseback, et cetera, et cetera. Over the course of almost two decades, as they continually duel each other for essentially no reason. Keith Carradine plays Armand Dubert, maybe?
I think Dubert is how they pronounce it.
Dubert. Yeah. Dubert. The T is dropped, yes. And Harvey Keitel plays Gabriel Farad. The film won the award for Best Debut Film at the Cannes Film Festival and was nominated for the Palme d'Or as well. That's what I got. I really hate how the word duelist is spelled in this title.
Why?
The title of this film, two L's. Very annoying.
I mean, it's just, the English way, right? The English way is the French way because we're watching a movie made by an Englishman about the French. Yeah, I mean, it's appropriate.
Two guys, two L's. Games. You know what I mean?
Neither of them wins, huh? Is what you mean to say? That's a take about the end of the movie.
We're getting in there.
We're going to get there. I do want to start off by saying, like, have you ever seen a man more clearly doomed than the first guy that Harvey Keitel duels with in this movie? Like,
dude, it rules.
It's
and
so
then you and then you
funny.
Hear that he's like the son of a mayor, and you're like, oh boy, oh buddy.
I mean, just to set the scene, he's like Harvey Keitel looking an absolute piece in this period where he's got like the military braids on the side, he's got a head full of hair, really striking eyes.
Harvey Keitel, an actor who can more convincingly play someone who has and wants to kill someone than perhaps any other leading man in history.
Than most people. Maybe Alec Baldwin. I don't know. I just saw him in Notting Hill, and he did seem like he was on the verge of something in that role even. But then we're faced with his opponent, assuming nobody, and he's just this sort of balding, schlubby-looking guy. He looks like they pulled him out of central casting and just threw him into like a poofy shirt, and he just gets shredded, obviously. Like
he actually does better than I would have expected, given
really?
what we were looking at there.
Especially
Harvey Keitel, you know, looking like he was just ready to fucking go.
He does get stabbed like through. It's like apart from the kind of fucking scalping that Keitel gets halfway through the film. It is kind of the most gruesome injury. Oh, no. Unless I'm forgetting something.
No. There is one really good injury in the second duel, which is the most like melee of the duels when they both are fighting with, like, I don't know. I think they're cavalry sabers, but Keith Carradine gets like just a chunk taken out of his shoulder and he's still fighting, and it's just dangling off of him. And it looks like a side of ham fell off of him. That's a very good bit.
Yes. That is chunky.
Yes. No, that you're right. Yep.
That is pretty gnarly. I think I would prefer that over sword 2 feet through.
You're right. Certainly less. You can come back a lot easier from the former than the latter, I think.
I think even they say that the mayor's son, the one that he skewers at the beginning, I think even that character lives.
He does technically live. Yep.
He's pretty fucked up. But no, that second duel is definitely like the one that got me the worst. Like the gashing that Farouk gets is one thing, but it looks like a slice of spam off of his shoulder, and it's just dangling there. And they
it's like the end of Metal Gear Solid 4 too. They fight until neither of them can stand up anymore, and they're just like sort of like hacking away at each other.
It is beautiful.
I did that just so that Cody would turn off his camera.
It is a precursor to
Cody. Metal Gear Solid 4 is basically a movie, so you don't need to turn that off.
I mean, he's judging, but we can find it on YouTube for you. It's like 16 hours long. I really like how in the first half of this movie. And I do say half because I paused it about around when it stopped feeling like this. It feels like everything is built to like undo the pageantry of both the like prospect of dueling and of military like might at the time, and generally like bourgeois society and the class that this tier of Hussites, was it Hussites? Yeah, no, Hussars. I'm playing a game where we're talking about the Hussites.
Hussars, although I want to say Hussars every time.
Yeah, it's French.
Fake language, TBH.
I mean, there's like this. There's stuff that I don't know if anybody else got this vibe, but like there's the stuff on screen where they're wearing poofy. It's kind of like I haven't seen Barry Lyndon, but I assume Barry Lyndon does this. Everybody's dressed all gaudy. There are people in like, again, pretty funny military fashion of the time, you know, like dual Jedi braids off the sides. There's a lot of stuff going on with like how just goofy everything seems and how heightened it seems and how it's downplayed by a lot of like lack of music and, you know, simple direction and stuff. But even like in the lack of consistency among dialogue and accents, like Keith Carradine is just playing a straight like Midwestern, maybe East Coast accent. Almost everybody else is doing some version of a British thing, except Harvey Keitel, who's doing like
Harvey Keitel is just doing Harvey Keitel. Yeah, 100%.
Truly. I mean, and I just think, I guess my take on like the first half of the movie anyway is there's so much being done both diegetically and for the audience that's like, oh, this is, we're trying to make fun of this whole Count of Monte Cristo heightened like dramatic thing to like level the playing field for the second half of the movie where things are getting a little more deranged, a little more direct, and a little more, maybe not like vile or confrontational, more confrontational than the first half, but a little more serious in a way, like a little more intentionally dramatic. Does that ring a bell with you, Aaron? Did you have that experience, this experience I had where everything felt a little silly until it suddenly didn't?
I would say that I don't know if this is going to be considered a hot take or not, but I quite like Ridley Scott's more kind of, let's say, his less grounded, kind of more fictional films like Blade Runner, Alien. I do like this film. I like him as a director. I am getting more and more annoyed by his insistence on kind of not putting in really any of the work for any of his like period pieces or historical films to like an almost like clearly intentional degree, right? Like, I think what he's going for is that like the spirit of these characters is like so strong that it represents this like era in like European, but like specifically like French history, and like these two characters as these very opposing kind of symbols. They, you know, represent the spirit of, the French Empire at the time. And it's like the decline of Napoleon. And like, I'm interested in all that, but like, I don't know, man, can someone speak in a French accent even once in this film? It's Carradine, not even attempting to do it. I mean, he sounds like he's from Ohio. It's so crazy, right? Keitel,
nah, man.
Very similarly, like not even try. Every single one of these films that Ridley Scott does he does not give a single shit at all. I did not see the new Napoleon. I heard the exact same thing about the new Napoleon.
Yeah, because dudes rock too hard to try to do accents. That's why.
You can't dudes rock your way through a fucking 45-year career based off that. Yeah. Right. Ridley Scott has a career of other historical epics, most of which are not good, largely for these kind of reasons and various other reasons, mainly. But like, I love Ridley Scott, but like, I don't know, it works in this film because it's like, it's a character study, right? It's like these two characters who are not even really people. They are like painted in like the broadest strokes, right? That are opposing each other and cannot come to any sort of reconciliation due to like the complete opposite nature of their characters, right? And like, yes, it works due to that. But like, I don't know, man. This seems to be like a running theme with Ridley Scott specifically, and it's a bit. I mean, it's kind of fun, but it's like a bit annoying, right? I guess there's like the interviews. You know, every time he has like a big movie, he's been doing this for like the new Gladiator movie that's coming out too. Somebody asks him about this in an interview, and he's like, "Hey, shut up! I'm knighted. You know, I'm Ridley Scott. Fuck you." You know, and like, yeah, he is. You know, good for him. But like, I don't know. It's a little grating, but like also this movie is maybe the best one of those that he's made. So, you know, it's fine.
It is fine. The stuff Aaron doesn't like about this movie, I like a whole heck of a lot. I'm just going to lead with that. But that was the coming off of having seen Napoleon and The Last Duel within the last couple of years, two movies I have seen, and I'm not going to do the thing where I say I haven't seen this, but I'm going to invoke it anyway. I've seen those. The DNA of I was thrilled to see that something like The Duelists, you know, is Ridley Scott's first formal feature that like we'd be able to get into, even if it was just broad strokes because of our collective mileage with it, that we're planting seeds here for the types of shit that he continues to be interested in across, even if it's not like explicitly within, you know, the stuff, obviously explicitly within the stuff that he's done recently. The middle chunk of his career is maybe less so tethered to these sorts of things specifically. The sort of, you know, like the interest in costume dramas as a set piece, the examination of specific relationships in those eras and across like the ensuing eras, and like finding a through line that is very, very human and relatable and also very stupid, as we see here, like these two dudes, like relatively early on, they start questioning, you know, why were we even arguing in the first place? I don't know, but I have nothing except my honor. And so unfortunately I have to proceed with this, my homie, my frenemy. And I guess, to your initial, kind of kickoff of this, Jason, I see it less so as like a skewering of those things, of those eras, more so just like a particular crafting, like latching onto the sorts of things that he wants to, and the fact that he could do it here, and I don't know, the cachet that he's built up over the years, and to still like do these sorts of things later on, is super cool. And like he's far from the only person to do that, right? Not to say that like Marie Antoinette is like the exact same flavor as this, but like modernizing and maybe even like skewering of those things is something that's like is certainly not beholden to just Ridley Scott. Not to say that it's bad to dislike that sort of shit. With Napoleon especially, that is the sort of consensus I got from like mutuals that I follow on Letterboxd and just people I've talked to, just like, yeah, the specific version of that is not really for me. Again, totally understandable. I've grown to like that sort of thing only more and seeing The Duelist as like the inception point for a lot of these things. The thing that Ridley Scott does immediately before Alien of all motion pictures is genuinely fascinating. I don't know. You kind of tipped your hand earlier, Harry, when you said that you were maybe on the positive side of all that. I don't know. How does that all align with kind of your reading of this? How do you feel about it?
Yeah, thanks. I really love that you brought up Marie Antoinette. It's not a movie I thought about while I was watching this movie, but now that you bring it up, I see a lot of parallels there. It really strikes me how, despite feeling almost like such a prototypical movie of Ridley Scott's, and almost kind of a prototypical movie of its time. This is nonetheless a sort of like understatedly audacious debut. I sort of agree with Aaron that like some of the elements of this movie that make it feel sort of like almost obnoxiously modernized are a little bit grating. But I also came to see that, I think similar to what you're talking about, Cody, as like one of the movie's strengths, in the sense that I think Aaron, you're exactly right when you say that, like, this is a movie that is only ostensibly about the French Revolution. And I think probably Ridley Scott borrowed that from, or not the French Revolution, I'm sorry, but the Napoleonic era of France, which he probably borrowed from Joseph Conrad, who wrote the original short story this is based on, which is also sort of only ostensibly about this time, right? It's like you had said, these are characters who are real, like, character sort of symbols. They're stand-ins for ideas, right? And I was really impressed in this movie with how, by putting these character stand-ins in this sort of obnoxiously modernized, updated idea of the times, it makes it a movie that is surprisingly applicable to our times, and to sort of like universal ideas about like both masculinity and class and decorum in a way that I was really impressed by. Like for instance, I love that, like, and I think the original short story gets at this even better, but David Carradine's character is like weirdly fascinated by Harvey Keitel's character, and in that, like, Harvey Keitel kind of represents in his own way the epitome of the type of man that his character should be. Keith Carradine's character, Armand Dubert, right? Like, this sort of man of action, but like, he is also clearly a fucking madman, right? Like, he literally like chases Hubert across France, basically, and makes it his entire life's work to kill this one random twink because he hates him so much, right? And like, and like everybody says, and like, even for his time, according to his contemporaries, everybody's like, oh yeah, that guy Dubert, he's a fucking mad, he's like, or I'm sorry, not Dubert, but Farrand, he's a fucking madman. Like, everybody knows he's off the chain, right? Like, he's just completely, but like, there is something like, something about the fact that he holds his honor in such high esteem, and he legitimately makes his living and dying on the idea of these death matches, these one-on-one duels. It makes him sort of like, nonetheless, this epitome of a certain kind of masculinity that is supposed to be ideal and is idealized even still by this society that has become sort of like in actuality so divorced from that idea of the masculine, like, hero, that like Keith Carradine has this really fascinating relationship where he becomes sort of as obsessed with Farrand as Farrand is with him, and we get to watch this play out really straightforwardly across their lives. It's the type of movie where like I kept waiting for a twist to happen that never really happened, and instead just the sort of like the straightforwardness of the dynamic between these two guys, it like led itself to so many different readings, and it has so much nuance, and there's so many different ways to approach sort of like what it means that these two guys are obsessed with each other, that it really made all of the elements sing for me, especially and maybe kind of ironically the parts that are a little bit tense, right? Like the hypermodernization and the sort of like myopia of the focus, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I just like going back to my maybe slightly too annoying complaints kind of about that sort of stuff. I guess like the reason that it really kind of annoys me a little bit is that like I do think that it's like totally a fair thing for like Ridley Scott to say like I am not concerned with like that sort of historical accuracy in my films, right? And especially with like him as a director, someone who like I think recently has been unfortunately like kind of known for like making a bunch of big $200 million flops, right? But someone who used to be a very good studio director who was able to work within the studio system and was able to like kind of mine gold out of like very unfortunate kind of circumstances, right? You know, I do think that like a lot of this is probably just very practical, right? Like yeah, if you have like a bunch of American and British actors, like you probably have an easier time getting this thing financed and made versus like everybody, you know, hiring French extras, getting French actors, et cetera, right? So like, I am like open to that. I guess like one of the things that like does annoy me about it is that like, as you like kind of started to touch on, I think that like all of the other aspects of this film are like so like finely done and like really well considered. I mean, this is like an extremely beautiful movie, right? Like the use of lighting in this, I think it's just like spectacular, right? I think there are like so many elements that are so nuanced, as you kind of touched upon, and subtle and like open to interpretation, that like something like the accents like do kind of annoy me.
That's right? Really fair. Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it's unfair, right? Like, I don't know. Maybe I'm just kind of harping on nothing because
I think that there's a weird consideration there, right? Where it's like, it's sure. Fair because like this is the type of movie where I could spend the entire podcast just talking about different aspects of these two men's relationships with each other. But like,
yeah.
A big part of those are like several aspects of that relationship actually do legitimately touch on like their placement in this society, right? Like the fact that Keith Carradine is like clearly of a higher class than Harvey Keitel is, clearly from a different part of France. If Harvey Keitel's character is even from France in the first place, again, this is all like very explicit in Joseph Conrad's original short story. To the point where they're
through
like,
the
oh,
narration.
Yeah, Harvey Keitel is like this short, swarthy, like dark skinned dude who is like, really like,
who is
clearly
a stand in for Napoleon, basically. Right.
And, like, yeah. But anyway, and like I think you're right in that, like, there are certain elements of this production that flatten a couple of those aspects. I think that the difference maybe for me, and your mileage may vary, is just that, like, I think that those anachronisms kind of enhance other aspects of this relationship that make up for it for me, but that's totally an opinion, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that like the kind of stuff that you're touching upon is like part of what people who are like really big Ridley Scott fans are like, that is like kind of his thing as like a really incredible, like truly like skilled filmmaker, someone who is like very skilled at using the language of film, specifically like the visual language of film, to convey things that typically would be very, very hard to convey, right? Like, I think the issue of like class that you brought up is something that, again, is like very explicit in the short story. It's like directly said, right? But like, I think the way that Ridley Scott like communicates that through, you know, the type of environments we see these characters in, the type of like conflicts that they kind of navigate around, right? Like
Keith Carradine's incredible acting. He's so good in this role as sort of a dandy, right?
And a bit of a doofus, right? Like becoming less of a doofus over time, I guess. But like, you know, we see Dubert, you know, navigate this kind of political kind of arranged marriage, right? Right. We don't see Keitel's character doing the same thing, right? I mean, that's like a very small example, but like Scott is able to like convey the class of these characters and how that kind of helps to drive this rift between them without ever having to like explicitly say it in the manner that like, you know, a short story would, or like a worse film would, right? Like we kind of intuitively get that. And so like, yeah, I think that like he is using that sort of stuff to like a greater effect, and I can't really like knock it too much for that, I guess.
I think I appreciated all the things that you said, that you, Aaron said, that you like, that are frictious for you. Like, I feel like I appreciate those a little more. I have not read the short story, Joseph Conrad's short story, upon which this is based, but I assume that it is easier to extrapolate from that into a larger statement about, you know, I mean, probably in a different way, but about class at the time, you know, at the time of Bonapartism, at like, you know, this specific period in French history during these various wars, and, you know, the willingness of men to go fight versus, you know, the desire for stability, et cetera, et cetera. I'm assuming like there are parts of it that are literary by nature that are easier to get or to communicate through the written word than they are through the visual medium. And I think that is why, instead of focusing on that so much, as with this, I mean, you could probably say a lot of the same things that I'm saying about this movie about Napoleon, the more recent, you know, his biopic from earlier this year. Like, that those parts are sort of necessary in order to make it work as a compelling movie of, you know, 101 minutes or whatever it is, that it has to become, as Cody said, kind of like a character study more than a period piece in some ways. It is like very much focused on the differences between these characters, what unites them, what sort of like how you, I mean, they're not like Odd Couple style directly, like, but they are built out to be completely different people. More so, Keith, I would say Keith Carradine's character is clearly the main character. And so we get a lot more of him than we do of Farrone, but like we
which get, I think is really important to this story, right?
It
it's super important that Farrone is like kind of like this madman on the fringes who is unknowable to us.
Yeah. And I mean, because like we are then sort of left to perceive him through the lens that we've built through Keith Carradine's character through Dubert. I don't know. I just feel like those parts don't introduce so much like a friction that stops me or irks me as it does like, oh, it's making me think about this thing, which I could have assumed sort of the rough outline of the story. I could have assumed like the tone and the vibe of it by knowing that it was set during, you know, the mid-1800s, that it was in France, that there was a Bonapartism angle, that it's two people sort of, out, you know, on opposite sides of a spectrum. I could have probably put those pieces together as a story, but seeing them fleshed out as a movie was like, that's where I started to appreciate the goofiness of it. Like, first I noticed there's no real consistency to the accents, and anybody who like, if you're going to recreate a period this accurately through costuming and through sword fighting, you're probably going to have an accent or dialogue coach on hand. And they just chose not to, maybe, or like, whatever.
Though they did have a very accomplished fight choreographer.
It is
which
it was fun
completely
to,
rules. It's like that's right. That's what you focus on. Like fuck the accents. You just got to get the sword play
that
right.
That is the thing. Ridley Scott is gonna be like, fuck. Look, we got a budget, all right, and we don't have a budget for fucking loser ass fucking, you know, diction coaches or whatever. We have a budget for a guy who's fucking sword fighting and gun duel.
Yeah,
right.
That's right. He's right.
For what it's worth, I did end up watching and like just prepping for this episode. End up watching a video. It's one of those like clickbait, you know, profession master reacts to media depictions of his profession thing. But it was I think it was a sword fighting or like a weapons master or something like that, judging different sword fighting scenes from different movies. And he went to the one, their first, maybe their second. It's the one where Keith Carradine is wearing like the Falconer's glove out in the field. And he sort of, it's the first injury he obtains. And he like, praises every second of this thing. He's like, yeah, they're sizing each other up. They're waiting. There's so much detail. Love that.
It even says in the Wikipedia that this is generally considered some of the most authentic swordplay ever captured on film.
That's how he like he covers a bunch in this video. I'll link it in the show notes. He covers a bunch in this video, but after the duelist, he's like, they ask him to rate each of the things and it's on a scale of 1 to 10. And he's like, it's the duelist. It's 10. It's always 10. Like it's the duelist. What are you asking? Like, I don't know. There's a fun like choice of authenticity there. That, yeah, I think is important of a whole lot of Ridley Scott's like filmmaking to that would follow in the decades to come, as Cody was saying. But like as a little nucleus of it's the late 1970s. He doesn't have a big budget yet. He like the maybe the like filmmaking language. And I really do want to get into this point at some point. The filmmaking language doesn't quite exist for like the fuck yeah blockbuster as it would come around in the 80s with John McTiernan, et cetera. Like that whole thing, that whole like Hollywood explosion of, you know, basically the most toyetic media possible. I think this is like a weird little codex for understanding a whole lot of that and seeing pieces of that in this. And I think like the weirder parts, the things that I like, the goofier parts are sort of the edges that would get sanded down in that going forward. Aaron, I'm actually done with that point now. If there was something that you wanted to hop in.
Did they talk about the James Bond Die Another Day sword fight scene?
I did not watch the whole thing. I just skipped straight into and out.
All right. Well, look, send me the link, you know, include it in the show notes. We'll check that sword fight scene. That movie, very bad. Awful. That sword fight scene, very good. Thumbs up.
Cody, I'll segue to you by asking, where does that movie fall in your ranking of Bond films? You've seen them all.
I've seen them all. That's in the lower third off the top of my head.
I mean, look, there's a lot of bad James Bond movies, you know, but that's a real bad one.
Yeah, that is a real stinker, if memory serves. I don't know if this will tie a bow on some of the points that we've been talking about or not, but I think what stands out to me, and it was, I had trouble mentally articulating this at the time, and even like it's kind of starting to crystallize now. But when Ridley Scott chooses to make some of these choices now, right? Like he is leveraging, he's by letting someone like Joaquin Phoenix speak with his like native, you know, regular accent. He is, it's an easier pathway to like leverage part of the Joaquin Phoenix persona or like the Matt Damon persona, the Adam Driver persona, thinking of like some of the actors that have been in his recent films that are in a sort of similar vein to this. Like he's leveraging not just those, but he's also able to leverage his like Ridley Scott filmography up to this point, even if it's not in any, again, like concrete, obvious way, but it's like, it's there. The fact that he, it chose to employ these sort of tactics with his like first feature film is kind of bonkers. I don't know. Maybe y'all will feel differently about it. I got thinking about, because this is part of the Harvey Keitel, like simmering fury, whatever the great name of the series is. And it's like, without me not knowing anything about this movie, I felt myself like Carradine, great in his role, as it's been discussed. He's a nice dandy. Like he plays off that super well. And we're kind of anchored to his character more. Harvey Keitel is on the other side of it. Throughout the film, I was thinking, you know, I would love to see his perspective in all this as well a little bit more. We have a couple scenes where it's, you know, Carradine isn't around. Dubert, isn't around. And we're just like, we're off of him. And all we really gather from his character, and like the scene will conclude and I'll be like, oh, okay, I guess like we really do know all that we need to know. There's like less of a, you know, he's a manic pixie dream, furious fellow. Oh, I can't think of a great one. Yeah. Just like he, the longer he sits with it, like it, if anything else, like very emblematic of just like the nastiness of certain facets of the human condition, where just like the initial sort of quote unquote offense, he sits with it. And the longer he sits with it, the more explosive he gets. He's like, actually, yeah, this really did piss me off. And like, we're going to fight now, come to think of it. And like, we get a scene without Dubert later, and he comes to spout fake news, basically. It's like, oh yeah, he was treacherous. He was like, he's an active threat against it, whatever shit he said. It's like, on one hand, I would have, it tough to look at it in retrospect and be like, I would have loved to have seen the like the simmering fury of Harvey Keitel is very present in the Farod character. And I would love to have seen even more of it, because seeing Harvey Keitel on screen is such a treat. At the same time, just like managing those doses in the sort of like compact but explosive scenarios, those fight scenes, first and foremost, the duel sequences rather, was like, I don't know, like tactful and conscious. And like, I came away positively enough on that. I don't know if the amount of Harvey we got was enough for you, Harry, or if that triggered anything, but that's, no. I think we can all agree. Harvey Keitel, great, right? Great man. Let's start with that. That's an easy one.
Here's a hot take. He's the hottest of Scorsese's three major boyfriends.
There we go.
But we don't have to get into that right now. I'm really glad you brought that up, because I really love the use of Keitel in this movie. It's extremely strange, especially for a movie that's called The Duelists, right? Like, you go into this movie thinking that this is going to be a character study of two men and their relationship with one another, and we're going to get to know both men very well. We do not get to know Gabriel Ferrone very well at all. He is a non-entity in this movie for the most part. He is unknowable. He seems psychopathic to us, in fact, right? And I think it's because we see him through the perspective of Armand Dubert. And I think that, like, the fact that we see him through Dubert's perspective is super important to this movie. And it makes Dubert fascinating to me as an audience surrogate, because he is sort of like this, he's this fascinating, like, almost contemporary man, right? Like, he is of a class position and of a sort of educational position that he walks through his life almost bemused, right? Like, here's a guy who, like, kind of fails upward throughout his career, right? Like, he keeps kind of screwing up, but like, he falls into this relationship with a woman who loves him. He eventually loses her, but because of his connections, he gets another relationship. He ends up being this very wealthy retired general who's held in good esteem, even though he was a Bonaparte general, right? He is able to sort of slither his way into French high society even after Napoleon's exile. And like, that is the source of the later grievance between Farod and Dubert, but like, that's not surprising at all to us, right? Because by now we understand, like, oh, like Dubert is going to get his, right? Like, above all else, like, this is not a guy with convictions. so much as he is a guy who knows how to play the political landscape in his favor to end up in the right spot. Because honestly, like, at least how I interpret it, he was born into it, right? Like, this is what he's been trained to do his whole life. Like, he's in the military as a means to an end, to build a reputation. He is constantly talking about how he's a man of his reputation. He is going to leverage that reputation into a cushy position in whatever government ends up when the smoke clears, right? And the dust settles. And he does so extremely successfully. And I think that's a huge aspect of this guy that is really important. And I think it's super important that, like, we understand him so much better than we would understand someone with legitimate convictions of this time, right? Because, like, we, the audience in 1970s or whatever, don't know what it is to be a Bonaparte partisan, right? Like, who knows what that really means? But, like, I think we can all recognize this dude who is sort of like a capitalist at heart. He's sort of just sort of like, oh, I'm going to play the cards that I'm dealt, and I'm going to use them. I'm going to use this hand that I play to leverage myself into better and better positions. And so, like, it's hilarious and absurd and so appropriate that, like, this guy is just, like, menaced and beguiled and bedeviled by this man who is his utter opposite, who is sort of, like, in his own way, like, all earnestness, where Dubert is all duplicity and, sliminess, right? And so, like, there is this really great foil relationship with them, where on the one hand, like, we can relate to Dubert because he is our audience stand-in and he seems sane, but on the other hand, like, there is something so compelling about the, like, kind of, like, partial truths of this man, Gabriel Farad, right? Where, like everything he says, like, for instance, when he talks about how Dubert is, like, this duplicitous dude who never actually had any love for Napoleon, he's fucking telling the truth, right? Like, it just so happens that, like, you shouldn't have any love for Napoleon because Napoleon was also a madman, right? And so, like, it, from our perspective, it's like, yeah, of course not. But, like, from the perspective of the time, like, Ferrand is making, like, a very good point about Dumont's character, where he's like, hey, like, we were all, like, ride or die for this army, and, like, there is this, like, fucking hot twink who thinks he's better than me, who never really believed in any of this shit, and because he never really believed in any of this shit, he's going to go on having a great life, and I can't tolerate that, right? Because yeah. I actually believed in this shit, or thought I did. And it's like, he's kind of right, and I love that he's kind of right, because it makes that ending hit so hard, right? And we can talk about the ending when the time comes, but, like, I think that, like, the what I'm trying to say, I guess, with all of this is that, like, the very controlled way in which this movie gives us information about both of our main characters, and the way in which, like, we only really get to see Hubert, but, like, even through Hubert, we get to understand how, like, even though this is the last thing he wants, Ferrand comes to sort of dominate his life and control his life. I thought that was really fascinating, right? Because it's like, it's such an interesting perspective where, like, we are, like, we can sympathize so much with this guy who feels so modern and is just being like, why is this fucking psychopath just so fixated on me? You know? And, like, I really liked that about this movie.
Yeah, I do like the idea you scratched at of where, like, instead of we're focusing on the absolute mad dog, insane, well, I say non-judgmentally, that the, like, pit bull of a human that is Faroe, we have, like, our lens, our character who gets spelled out much more being, like you said, Harry, this snaky character, like, the guy who just exists in the footnotes of history. He gets by failing upward. He does turn coat after Bonaparte is exiled, and he, like, survives that way.
He's such an audience surrogate that, like, we kind of, like, we don't even realize that he's kind of a snake, right?
Until a certain point when, like, his snakiness is somewhat revealed. We were talking about how he becomes a little bit less goofy over the course of the movie, and it's because he becomes less, I think it's because he becomes less, like, empathetic, more, less sympathizable when, like, he decides to start foregoing, you know. There's the Russian attack where he's with Bonaparte's troops, and they're, you know, tasked with going out and killing you know, wandering bandits, and that he decides to go with him to try and make amends. And that's maybe the last time that he's like a sympathetic character where you see him trying to extend an olive branch. And then otherwise it's just like, okay, this guy kind of deserves a little bit of comeuppance. So over the course of the movie, it shows like it gets to him feeling like I kind of wish like he had, because he had slimed his way through and up into the ranks, I kind of wish he had died, like been the one to
that's right,
die.
Right. And like there is something about like, oh, of course, this is the only way this movie went, right? Like the inheritor of the earth inherits the earth, and he does it through his beguiling sort of like politicizing. And like, even though we know that like this is how the world is won, there is like an incredible like tragedy to the very end of this movie, right? Where it's like, on some level, like even though we know it's stupid, even though we know it's like hyper masculine and toxic and stuff, like we wanted to see Pharaoh come through and like run this guy through and sort of like be like, oh, okay, like there is something genuine in the world.
Right. And I don't know, maybe it's I don't think it's time yet to talk about the ending because there will be time, but I do want to get to in Keith Carradine's, in Dubert's story, there's like the only intimations of anything outside of a life of military advancement and war and this conflict. And it's in, I forget the character's name even, but the prostitute that he falls in love with, that he, you know, sort of sees a future with that doesn't pan out. She ends up leaving him in a really great shot where she writes goodbye on his saber.
Laura. She writes goodbye and lipstick on his saber. And then so we cut to him using that saber in a duel. Fuck yeah, dude. And the juice. Ridley Scott's got the juice.
It's such a good image. In the scope, scale and scope of this movie, it's a really good image. But there's like, even that, I think, I don't want to say that I don't see any depth there. Like there are scenes where we get them interacting with each other, where we like learn about her, we learn about him, we like learn about their relationship, and it does like change over the course of maybe a whole 40 minutes that she's like as part of it. But like I just don't know that maybe textually, maybe on purpose, it doesn't feel like that because like that's a consistent point of the story. Is like, I don't know, for a movie where I think the poster, like the release poster, talks about passion and like it builds it alongside revenge and vengeance and all these other like tropes that appear in the movie. It does not feel like that important a part of the movie, their relationship, at least to me in the grander scope of things. And I think if I had to attribute that, it's because the point of the movie is him and Pharaoh and like his inability to adapt to Pharaoh's like decency, not decency, but like his commitment and dignity and perceived honor and like his passion for what he does, as opposed to Keith Carradine, who like is the believes in nothing, will go with anything type guy who happens to succeed in ways that Pharaoh can't with, you know, quote unquote, normal civilized society. I don't know. It just like, it makes me think of if that is, it's sort of like what I was talking about earlier with the whole like leading into the 80s style of filmmaking where there's, you know, there's driving plots and there's, you know, romantic interests, and they're just pieces that just exist alongside one another as movies start to become streamlined and more marketing, it becomes like more, you know, audience research comes into play. And like that starts to be what drives storylines and what drives plot structures. And it feels honestly a little bit like that. Like we've included a love story because if there wasn't one, somebody
ooh,
might
like
ask.
It's a meta commentary.
Maybe, but like again, before a time, I guess movies were made in that style before 1977. But like for the kind of provenance that this movie has, and for the sort of a future that its director would have, I guess I see. I find it hard to immediately dismiss the whole like romantic subplot off the bat because it does like affect the character's motivations. I just don't know that it like has the heft or weight that I would have expected it to, or that the character is as fully fleshed out as maybe one would assume based on like her presence in the story to begin with. Did you think about that portion of the movie at all, Harry? Did it leave this stick with
yeah
you?
Absolutely. I like that you bring this up. Laura was her name, by the way, and I think that like your criticism that maybe she wasn't a fully developed character is definitely founded. I think she mostly exists to deepen Carradine's character arc, right? Dumont's character arc. So that objection sustained. That being said, I found their relationship really fascinating because of how modern and passionate and contemporary it felt in comparison to everything else, right? Like Dubert is a character to me who is established as, I think you aptly said, he believes in nothing, right? And he's a character who's sort of bemused by the politics of the age and the decorum of the age, this idea that you have to be honorable, this idea that you have to establish your reputation as a red-blooded male.
Right, right. He doesn't even remember what their first argument is about right after.
Right, exactly. It's like bemusement is like a big, and like that characterizes their relationship so well for me, right? Is that like, oh yeah, like they know that they like have this attraction, that they're super into each other, but like all the time, like they're sparring with each other, and like they're almost like the root of their connection is they're both people who see through the sort of like false veneer of society as it exists in this day and age, right? Like she even says like, oh yeah, there's this guy who wants to marry me, but I'm gonna forego love and like make do with you, right? And it's because they're like they're confidants and partners, right? And it's the way in which they're confidants and partners is because they're above it all, right? Because they're like looking down on the world from this upper perch where like, oh, like because we see through all of this bullshit, like we can get past it. And that's what makes their breakup so fascinating to me, right? Is this idea that like Dubert just can't get over it. Like he can't stop like dueling with, like that's the crux of their breakup, right? Is she's like, oh, you can't cure a duelist, right? It's like, no, nobody knows why you're so obsessed with this Faroe guy. Like you're as obsessed with him as he is with you. And like, I don't understand that. Like, just stop, just go away, just drop out of the military or whatever. And he just can't do it because of his pride, right? And because at the end of the day, like, even though he understands how stupid the crux of this argument is, he can't help but like be seduced by it anyway, which is so much about what this whole movie is to me, right? And part of the whole movie that makes it feel so like right to me, and especially as like a really good sort of like indictment of a kind of masculinity, where it's like, I love that like Dumont like understands so intimately that like his life is stupid, right? That like militarism is stupid and this idea of being an honorable man is stupid. But there's just something about the fact that this dumber guy who's never had the opportunities that he has actually believes this stuff that like makes him like obsessed with still like confronting this guy. Like, right. It's like, even though he doesn't believe it, the fact that this other guy does believe it makes it something that is worth taking note of, even though he doesn't want it to. Right. So like in the process, he ends up allowing his entire life and his entire person to be defined by this other guy's belief system, even though he knows this guy's belief system is absurd. Right. And it's like, that is such a fascinating, analysis of what masculinity is. Right. And it makes this ending hit so hard. Right. And I thought that was a really fascinating aspect of this movie. How did you feel about that, Cody? And how did you feel about Laura's relationship with, Dumont in general?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess first and foremost, I think it's no secret that Ridley Scott doesn't always have the best handle on like how to utilize women characters in his films. Laura and
Vanessa Kirby in a biopic about Napoleon, and she's in like 35 minutes of it. Come on.
Yeah.
Did make Alien.
He did make
that
Alien.
That is a point in his
you
favor.
Know what? I take it back.
Very
for
strong.
Sure.
Yeah.
He also made Blade Runner. So
you know what? I take it back again.
Wow. Win some, you lose some. I don't think anybody here has seen Ridley Scott's Robin Hood.
I have. Yeah, right? Actually, it's like a tea party
well.
Metaphor. It's a wildly bad
film.
Movie. Yeah, it's a terrible
it's
movie.
Incredibly bad.
Looking forward to seeing it.
Like a Master and Commander one. The guy, what's his
that
name?
That is not Ridley Scott.
The actor.
Russell Crowe?
Russell Crowe. Why couldn't I remember that motherfucker's name? The Pope's Exorcist.
It's also a really funny movie because it is a prequel to Robin Hood, but Russell Crowe plays Robin Hood. So it's just like, oh, so like, was Robin Hood like in his mid-60s during the like the legendary Robin Hood days?
That's
because
cool.
Like that motherfucker is like a not particularly spry 55-year-old man in that movie. And it's supposed to be like before he does any of his Robin Hood shit. Anyway, I digress.
Yeah, no, we'll clip that. That'll be the on socials. That'll be the teaser for this episode. 2 hours on Ridley Scott's Robin Hood. Getting back to women, fellas. Laura in particular plays into that kind of like what you were articulating here, the like this movie poking and prodding at Dubert's masculinity, pride, honor, like everything sort of that umbrella. And it's very much like that's what's an annoyance for Dubert at first, you know, as soon as it starts to affect his relationships, his career, he's kind of like whatever, because like you said, I think behind the veil of everything, like these guys see behind like the, or they see past the, I don't know, the big old curtain and just like, this is fucking stupid.
Right.
But he keeps failing upward, like you said, and we can kind of read it. Like, I think these two guys play that very well. But you know, he wipes the lipstick off the saber and, You can see this shit eating at him more and more, and it all kind of culminates by the climax, right? Like the first time we see an explosion of that is through that duel on horseback, where it's like a very manic, frantically edited, just like he's thinking back to all just like these little things that have been festering at him, and like again, like they're annoying all of a sudden, like this is an obsession, what my main draw is for being alive, whether I want to admit it or not. And then he leaps over the cart and rides away. And all of that, is to say, cause we were talking about the ending a little bit and like whether or not, the ultimate, kind of conclusion of that work by the end of it, the sort of, you know, the things that Dubert, like his successes, you know, his failings, those are clearly weighing on him a lot. He even his leg is all fucked up. I think they said it's like on its way to getting healed or something. I don't think we ever see him in like fully like 100% mode again by the end of the picture, in the duel that he's like not, I don't know, the conditions or whatever. So that's probably playing into it as well. But the, like he seems to be resigned to like whatever fate awaits him. Like he got married. He doesn't really seem all that into getting married, even though Adele seems like quite a catch. Like she's interested in him. It's a win-win. Yeah.
He possesses this fantastic characteristic, like disaffected bemusement, where he was sort of like, oh, well, I guess this is what's happening to me now.
Right.
And like, I guess that's a pretty good deal, so I'm going to go with it, right? And like, you really get the feeling that like, oh, Dubert was always going to be all right, right? He was trained to like sort of land on his feet.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And that made me think going into the end where he's staying up all night. You would think you'd want a good night's sleep before going into a life or death duel. That's just me.
That's the difference between you and I, Cody, and that's why you're going to win our inevitable duel, is that the night before I would definitely stay up all night and you would get a good night's sleep and then we would meet in the forest or whatever and you would absolutely destroy me. Yeah.
I don't know. Well, episode 300, baby, stay tuned. I don't know. Like all this sort of like we're hemming and hawing about like this dude's pride, and by the end of it, like he just I don't know. I'm kind of circling the drain, but like the one calling back to like a scene at the beginning that I also think like maps like gestures at this whole dumb like internal conflict of these men, Dubert specifically, but like him. There's like during, I think like duel one or I think it was the first, maybe the second duel, he sneezes. And there's like this element of decorum, just like, oh, like, hey, hold on, buddy.
What a great moment. Oh my God, what a good moment.
And then that sets the table later for this, like the natural impulse to sneeze versus the mental override of like, hey, if you distract yourself, you won't have to sneeze. Just like talk about what honor is. Specifically, recite the textbook definition to me of what honor is. And he's like, well, honor is, it's this fucking thing. Just like, the writing's on the wall. Excellent table setting. Not a junk drawer thought because I thought it was directly relevant, and it starts to lay the framework that for this like restlessness that this dude is clearly like, while like Faroe has that like fury beneath the surface, there is a restlessness with Dubert that plays all the way to the end. The fact that he, I don't know, like gets to the fact that he overcomes that and is like, all right, I own you now, is like not the ending that I expected. I don't dislike it, but it I don't know, maybe we feel differently. That is kind of me ham-fistedly shoving us towards the ending of the picture. Thank Jason you. if that's good by you.
Thank you. Your ham fists carry us all the way to the ending.
Delicious ham fists. And on Easter. So appropriate.
Hey, yeah, it's appropriate. Pressed ham. I saw your microphone come on. Did you have a response to the ham fist things?
I thought I did, but then I thought better of it. And we'll save that for later. Go ahead.
I'm glad you pulled us toward the ending, pushed us, pulled us with the hammy hands. Because I think it ties, like, following the thread of Dubert's, like, disaffected bemusement, like Harry keeps saying, like, he's got this, going into the climactic ending, or excuse me, the climax, like, the very ending of the movie, from about when he is fully settled down with Adele and her, you know, her dad's estate or whatever, to when Furrow's men confront him on his property. Like, there is this, up until that point, he's got this, like, his fear of losing what the things he's gained is just gone by the end. Like, he has, like, this preciousness of them. Earlier on, he sees through the stupidity of, you know, honor and the code and single combat and the, you know, military. He sees it as a path to something else. Like, he doesn't reveal that to the audience very often. You're positioned to see them as pretty much equally committed to their causes until that starts to unravel for at least Dubert over the course of the movie. But that's it. By the end, it's replaced by, like, this apathy. And I think by the very end, and just to set it up for the listener, Pharaoh's men show up, demand a duel. Dubert acquiesces. The next morning, they meet at dawn with two pistols, one shot in each pistol. And they go into the ruins, this old, chateau ruins on the property. And whoever, you know, may the best man win. Dubert wastes no shots. Pharaoh wastes one upon seeing Dubert. Neither of them is hit, and Pharaoh wastes his last shot, misses completely, which I guess was pretty common, pretty easy to do with a flintlock pistol. And with one shot left, Dubert,
I wouldn't have, decides, for the record, I would have hit him.
Yeah, but I mean, it was close enough. He should have definitely. But with one shot left, Dubert decides to spare Pharaoh and say, okay, well, according to the rules of single combat, you are now mine. You're honor bound to me. Basically,
Wookiee, you know, life debt.
Pretty much. I own your ass. And I command you to, like, never, like, you will ignore me in every professional and personal capacity. You know,
we're going to find you another island. It's not going to be the one Napoleon's on, but it's another one. You have to do your exile there, bitch.
Elba too. It's, like, he has this opportunity to win diplomatically instead of violently. Again, continuing his trend of, like, he's going to climb the ranks one way or another. He doesn't tend to fuck people over. He just tends to snake his way by and take opportunities and, like, hand down this pity to Pharaoh when he can. You know, he spares his life on the as a Bonapartist toward the end. He tries to make amends with him in Russia, and, like, he tries to bring pity and some sense of humility to the role that he knows doesn't really need it. And then by the end, he knows that it's going to be the thing that bites Pharaoh the most to not, you know, have died in honor in single combat as he, like, has been hurtling toward the whole movie, his whole career, presumably. And I guess, Harry, I don't know if this is where you were going to take it, but, like, that leaves me wondering, where does that leave Pharaoh? We don't get a whole lot of monologue from him toward the end, because Dubert just, like, talks at himself in voiceover, and then Pharaoh is just seen overlooking the lowlands, the low country, in this beautiful shot that closes the movie, and looking, you know, sort of lost, sort of, like, unsure what to do next. Where do you think that leaves Pharaoh, and
yeah,
how do you think this movie ties that all off?
Really well characterized, Jason, and set up. I ended up loving this ending. I felt the way that Cody did about it at first, to be fair. But I think that, like, what's fascinating to me about Dubert is that throughout this movie, what he wants is Pharaoh's respect desperately, more than anything else. He wants to be seen as a legitimate equal to him. He wants to squash the beef, right? Like, to the point where he goes on a suicide mission with Pharaoh in Russia to kill Cossacks that nobody else will go on, because he just wants to show off, like, hey, Pharaoh, like, we're both cool bros that are hardcore for real, dude. So, like, you can, like, let this beef die, because, like, I'm not a dandy. I'm not just a politician. Like, I'm as hard as you are, bro. And, like, and finally, he wins the sort of begrudging respect of Pharaoh by disrespecting him, right? like you said, like the worst thing that could happen to Ferrell at the end of this movie is that he isn't killed in a duel, because then at least we would kind of understand that like Ferrell's legacy was living on in some ways, right? That like Dumond was like bringing something of Ferrell into the future, so to speak, with him, because he finally bested Ferrell on his terms. But instead he erases Ferrell entirely, right? He's like you, I've lived under your definition of honor for so long. Now you're going to live under mine. I'm not going to kill you. I'm instead going to dismiss you, right? Like you didn't actually exert this power over me. You weren't actually this foil for me, even though, you know, Dumond thought he was. Instead, he completely casts him aside, and we get this amazing ending, right? That's kind of like melancholy, and I really admire that. Like Ridley Scott leaves it in melancholy, because I don't even know that the Joseph Conrad story was necessarily melancholy. Maybe you would disagree with that, Aaron, but I really love that. Like here, it's like there is something worth mourning about the end of somebody like Ferrell, as ridiculous as he was, and as like anachronistic and bullish and single-minded as he was sort of like the genuine article, right? He actually did believe in like the bullshit of sort of like honor and chivalry and dueling.
Yeah, it's the end of an era, not just of a guy, you know.
Right, and it's the end of an entire idea, right? And like insult to injury is that like Dumond is able to transcend that and move into the future without acquiescing to it in the slightest. Instead, he very characteristically sort of demands his way out of it, right? He sort of like tricks Harvey Keitel's character into discharging his pistols. And then he says like, hey, I'm not going to kill you because that's beneath me, right? Instead, like I'm going to like technicality my way out of this death match that we've had. And you sort of like, you can see like, oh, that's the future writ large, right? Like it's the end of one era and the beginning of another, and it's sort of inevitable, right? Because like guys like Dumond were always going to inherit the world. But like I really love that this movie ends on a note that there is something kind of sad about the end of that era, even though it's sort of like in inevitability, and even so that even though that era itself was never anything really worth championing, right? It's like I love that both of those things can exist in this movie, that like Gabriel Ferrell was like a psychopath, like kind of just an idiot, and like he represented one end of a spectrum, but like even so there is something melancholic about that being over forever,
right? And that like this version of diplomatic violence and war and mongering is like it will live on, because Dupere is its torchbearer.
In some like, ways, the worst man won, right?
Precisely. like the one that, again, he like slithers through the footnotes of history. He like gets by with the real power plays. Presumably, after this, not only does he have like a wealthy estate and the, you know, prestige of having served valiantly in two armies and, you know, been a royalist, he then like, he now owns one of Bonaparte's,
a shapeshifter, like, yeah, right,
like most fervent followers and most violent like enforcers. He now like has that. So it's sort of like this opening of a door right at the end toward like, oh well, you kind of know where this went, like, you know, World War One and a century of like colonization,
right. Like,
and like just imperial power is taking over. Like it, you sort of see it, it's sort of like the little nucleus of that. I mean, it parallels really fun I did just a little bit of research on like the like decline of duels as a concept, as like a thing that people did. And apparently by the mid 1800s, it was mostly gone. Like the Age of Enlightenment had pretty much pushed out the idea that we needed to settle our feuds this way. But right before the end, they switched to, flintlock pistols as like, this will level the playing field. This will make things easier. You can be like a master swordsman and the local pub drunk, and you can both have an equal chance of winning because these things suck. Like they're not good at aiming or killing people. They're mostly good at maiming and like, you know, close quarters murder. But I guess just like looking from that point where Dubert spares Ferrell's life, you sort of get this very ominous, like, oh, well, the sane guy won, and that's why it's a fucking problem. That's like, why it is the darkest possible timeline that we've entered here toward the end of this movie.
It sure is stupid and childish to believe in something, but it kind of beats the alternative.
Yeah, exactly.
I just want to quickly clarify. Duels are still very much happening. Jason, for being a LinkedIn guy, as much as you are, you should know this better than anybody. People just getting into duels.
For being a LinkedIn guy, as much as you are, devastating. I feel like that. I just watched Jason get impaled by.
Yeah, I do
the
feel like I had my
blade.
Throat torn out by a wild dog. Right. Now.
I would say you'd have to get up pretty early in the morning, but I know full well that Jason, you wake up earlier than any of us. Probably right. We don't have to get into that now.
5:45 a.m. Central Time.
I woke up at 5 this morning.
Yeah, not on purpose.
You sound like it.
No, I did. I've been going to bed early. I've been taking creatine. Speaking of which, halfway through this recording, I thought about running and getting a melatonin really quick, but I didn't. So if my sleep is rough, it's due to the...
It's on my ass.
Yeah, it's on your ass, bud.
It's on the pod.
Sleeping on your ass, bub.
Cody, was that your last point? It was just to dig me about LinkedIn?
Sure. If we want to call that a point, then yeah, I suppose.
I will, and I will wonderfully sign off the end of this episode, former discussion, and open up the junk drawer. It's where we put all the things that we didn't get to talk about over the course of the episode. I'll let Aaron take it away first, because I think he might have a thought or two rolling around the very front of this little drawer here, the things that pop out first, you know?
Yeah, I don't know if I made this. Maybe I made this joke earlier, but it's also true. Is there a lamer kind of sword in all of history than the French dueling épées or rapiers, thin? You know what I mean? Sabers they're using for the second duel that we see in the film, the first duel amongst them. That's pretty sick. But the very first duel, like the intro with the mayor's, fucking son or whatever.
Yeah.
Those swords suck.
What you're imagining when you think of an Italian or a French person killing another person, you think of the rapier.
You cannot name a worse sword than that.
Unfortunately, though, like if you're asking, like I would probably take that sword over the saber in like a duel because like it would be way easier to kill somebody.
Duels, it's like you prick someone, you both back away.
I'm saying that like if somebody else had a saber, I would take that sword because that sword is so fast and it has so much more range. And like when you're using the big cavalry sabers, like they were doing big telegraphed like swings at each other. With the little one, you could just like you could definitely like
yeah, but it
dance
sucks.
Around.
Okay. Where's
no,
your
I mean,
honor, sir?
I'm, no,
Where
I mean I'm
honor?
With you. But
there,
like
you lack the theatrical nature of the,
it's
the
a better
broad sword being swung like
is,
a pirate.
It's a better idea and a worse sword. I agree.
This is dangerously close to the knife versus baseball
knife
bat
versus
conversation
bat, yes.
We've had multiple times
bat,
before.
Way.
Yeah, true. It's a good discussion.
It's a bat.
I reject the idea that it's like the worst sword fighting sword because I imagine there must
Naval
be a couple
war.
That I've
no, no, no,
done
not worst sword fight.
Okay, okay.
Worst. One, the worst one. It's the land. It's the that shit sucks.
I mean,
get that the fuck out of here.
Okay,
I don't want to see
no,
that anymore.
Now, hot take. I love, I love the scimitar, the curved sword
of the
Arabian
the
Peninsula.
The little twangy, like yeah
love
fun.
That thing.
It
seems like it would be completely useless in actual combat. I don't really see the value of a round sword against a guy who
far,
can reach you
that's
from 6 feet away.
They're far worse. That's the problem, right? And it's like it's an interesting. It's like Dubert is the AP, and Harvey Keitel, Faroe is like the saber, right? Where it's like the saber is badass and it looks awesome, and that's what I want to see. But like the AP would win, right? Like,
no one is denying the practical nature. I'm just saying, like I am saying that the elementary school square pizza is the worst pizza of all time. And you're like, well, it feeds the most people. It's like, not even
it's
the point.
Got,
that
so like,
shit
it's,
is
it's,
trash.
So you're like,
get
it's
the
got
fuck
no
out
juice.
Of here.
It doesn't have the juice. It doesn't have what it takes to make it kid. Like,
yes. Fun bit about, I don't know if this is the rules of French dueling is the same, but in kind of classic, medieval era, fucking sword dueling with big kind of, thick European swords. It was illegal. It was like banned to simply like stab with your sword straight forward because that was a foining and it was considered a cheap maneuver because a 5 foot, 6 foot tall man foining with a 4 foot long sword could reach 10 feet And so well, it's just like
how, unfortunately, right, yes. you learn about like actual ancient combat, and it's like swords were never used because they were actually like, they looked really cool, but a spear is just undeniably a better weapon. Because if you like can,
swords were used.
If you can stand like 8 feet away from a dude and just sort of like keep him 8 feet away from you and eventually impale him on something sharp, it's like way better than, I mean, look, I'm a sword guy for sure. 100%.
I'm watched a lover, anime not a fighter up. Myself. Right. But so, yes.
Well, I'm not a lover. I'm a fighter and I'm a sword guy. I've killed many people with swords. But I have to, even I have to admit, right, that
for maybe lesser combatants, they maybe should pick up a spear, is what you're saying.
Right.
For those that don't have your panache.
My incredible commitment to the blade. Yeah.
Yes.
I don't know. I don't think you'll find a whole lot of friends here, Aaron, who don't like the rapier to the point that you don't like the rapier, but like there is a tier here.
Shit's trash. The little guard on it, awful. Can't even chop. You have to stab. You have to do the little stab where it gets like all bendy and shit.
No,
fuck,
I mean,
that. You cannot
true.
Just like cut someone's arm off.
The one where Dubarry
like it's sharp, but it's not chopping.
That's when they're fighting with sabers, right? Yeah.
That's
okay. So here's the thing. The first and several like accidents, injuries, none of these are accidents, injuries that occur in this movie are like slashes with the tip of it. It's like, you made
rapiers.
Contact and you ripped. Like there's still value there. It's not just a poke and dead. It's like,
I'm not saying there's not value. No one is denying the value, Jason. I don't know. It just sucks.
I actually agree with that. I'm with Aaron on this one. Because it's like, I don't know. I want a katana. A katana is like the utter opposite, right? Where it's like, that's all slashing.
Yeah.
And all like cool and impractical bullshit.
I want a big thing you have to hang over both.
That's right.
You know what I mean?
I like a Dark Souls
like a giant metal plate. That's exactly right.
The Buster Sword from Final Fantasy and or the Zweihanders from Scotland or whatever.
Well, yeah. There's a different place.
Oh, yeah, you're right. No,
it's
Germany.
Yeah.
It's Germany. It's the Zweihander, of course.
My juncture thought is it's really cool to hear Stacey Keach in the background of this movie. Just matter-of-factly describing what's going on and how military fashions have changed every like 15 minutes when we get into a scene. That rocks. Harry, Cody, any junk drawer thoughts before we get to our second and final segment?
I mean, we touched on this briefly, but I do just really love the premise of this movie. That it's just like, hey, like, what if there was a psycho who absolutely was hell-bent on killing you and you that was just your whole life? Like, just whatever was going on. Like it's like, oh, you're advancing in your career, you're meeting your future wife, you're sort of settling down, and just in the background there's just this fucking guy this guy who just will not leave you alone. And it's just like you're like afraid of, like, you walk into a bar and you're afraid of running into his friends because like his friends are gonna point him out. Yeah, it's so good.
It's mythological. It is like the Green Knight. It is like,
yes,
my end is somewhere around the corner and I don't know it yet.
And maybe my favorite in this is just like there's this scene where like Dumont learns that Pharaoh is in the same bar as him by like utter happenstance, and you see all the color drain out of his face, and then like he's almost out of there and some drunkard grabs him and he's like, holy shit, I know you, you're Pharaoh. And he's just like, he looks horrified, and then like you see Pharaoh turn around and he just holds up three, which is the number of duels that they've been in to this point. Or I think it's, they're going to have their third duel.
I think it would be the third one. He's like, three?
He doesn't even say anything. He just holds up three fingers, and then we cut to their duel. And it's so fucking good. That was extremely funny to me. The other really good part is the biggest dude's rock moment of this movie, when Hubert and Farad are taking on the Cossacks in Russia. And, Dubert shoots down and like kills a bunch of Cossacks at long range with his pistols, and then he looks over at Dubert and he's like, pistols next time. For like the next duel that they're going to have. I was like, fuck, that's so cool. Dude's rock. It was like a Michael Mann moment in this movie.
He hits a couple of them, and for some reason I read that as like he's saying that because he knows that they're like not, that Dubert, that Pharaoh's probably not very good with pistols, being like a swordsman. So, like, hey, jokingly, we should use pistols because I'm going to kill you if we use pistols, right? Like, I read that as another little fun character moment, but it is, like, inarguably a dude's rock moment where they're both freezing to death. They both have like blue faces. It's great.
And also Pharrell remembered it for the rest of his life. And like when he finds him on his estate fucking 15 years later or whatever, he's like, remember, we're dueling with pistols.
They're old men. It's great. My junk drawer thought, oh no, sorry, I already pulled out Stacey Keach, the junk drawer thought. So I gotta, I'm recycling junk drawer thoughts. They're getting stinky, a little musty in there. So I will close out the junk drawer for right now. And yes, the sound effect is playing. I will open up our new favorite segment, fan favorite. We've gotten a lot of really positive feedback on this segment. It's called To All the Loves We've Tried Before. We've landed on a name that I think everybody really likes and can agree with. For 1977, the year of this movie's release, we've covered on episode 2 and then episode 42, Houseu. It's the only movie I know of or that I can think of that we've covered twice on this podcast. The second episode, just as good as the first. Great time. Maybe we'll have a third at some point. And then episode 93, and we have almost three times as many episodes as that now. Maybe? Almost. Sorcerer. William Friedkin's Sorcerer. Freakin' Friedkin series. What a fucking movie, right? Fellas, it was a great time.
Hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
I just watched an episode of The Simpsons that makes a Sorcerer reference where Homer has to very slowly drive a truck across a rickety bridge in like a rainstorm, and he's super afraid of going over, and then when he's halfway over the bridge or like three-fourths over the bridge, he just like goes dope, and then it zooms out and you see like the Brooklyn Bridge or like a completely sturdy normal bridge right next to that he could have taken the whole time. It was a good joke and it made me think of Sorcerer, so shout outs.
Such a good movie. Check out episodes 93 on Sorcerer and episode 93 and episodes 2 and 42 on Houseu. Good shit. We also covered another Nobuhiko Abayashi film. I forget what number it was. His Motorbiker Island during the pandemic. Didn't play the trial on. Maybe someday. But keep it tuned to our old episodes. Zoom in and click and type into our backlog for movies that maybe you've seen before, or just keep scrolling. There's a lot of them now. And more to come. Check them out. I don't know why we're doing a plug that early. We have still one segment left to the show. Harry always helps me introduce this, so I'll ask him to do it again now. Harry?
Yeah, it's the best segment yet. It's the segment we like to call
Cody's Noties.
Wow. Thank you, gentlemen. That intro will have a hold on me for 15 years thereabouts. This week, we will be taking a close but kind of odd angled look at Ridley Scott's filmography through something I like to call Spot the Scott. I will read off a movie tagline, and one at a time, I will hit on each of you. I will hit on each of you. I'll try to woo you. I'm going to ask each of you to try to determine which Ridley Scott film the tagline belongs to. Each tagline will come with three choices, so you have the opportunity to hashtag cover the spread or gamify it any way you want, but I will still bust out the Spinner app to determine the answering order for each tagline. Points will be awarded based on correctness of guess. Noodles, not Googles. That's another hashtag. You kind of get it. So let's go ahead and jump in. I will give y'all the first of five taglines. So here's the first tagline. And it is as follows. There are two sides to the American dream. And your options for Ridley Scott movies. So option A is American Gangster. Option B, Matchstick Men. Option C, Thelma and Louise. Those are your three Ridley Scott movie options. The spinner has landed on, if you can see that, Jason first. So Jason, which of those Ridley Scott films does that tagline belong to, per your estimation?
Brain neutral guess, I'm going to go American Gangster. Never seen any of these movies, I don't think.
Jason is going American Gangster, duly noted. Let us spin the app, and it is going to land on Harry. Second guess, what do you think? Cover the spread, or are you going to land with Jason?
I'm going to do Thelma and Louise, Cody.
Gotcha. Harry, Thelma, and Louise. And Aaron, bringing up the rear for this question, covering the spread or one of the previously guessed options?
I'm going to cover my ass and guess the right answer, which is, I think, Thelma and Louise.
Thelma and Louise. Locking it in for Aaron. The correct answer is American Gangster. Ridley Scott's American Gangster.
Brain nooch.
Sometimes the obvious one is the right one, I guess.
really makes you think. So Jason is first on the board with 1 point to Harry and Aaron's 0. I don't know why I'm giving the score update so early, but hey, it's still very much anybody's game. Tagline number 2 is as follows. Man has made his match. Now it's his problem. That is the tagline. Your 3 Ridley Scott film options are option A, Alien. Option B, Blade Runner. Option C, Legend. Those are your 3 Ridley Scott options. And the first guess is going to go to Aaron. Aaron, what Ridley Scott film does that tagline belong to?
I would bet my life savings that it is Blade Runner.
Aaron is going with Blade Runner, locking that in. Over to our next guess, which is going to come from Jason. Jason, what's your pick?
I, too, will say Blade Runner.
Jason will, too, say Blade Runner. Harry, impossible for you to cover the spread, but are you going to align with the other fellas? Or
no, let's just go ahead and neutralize this one. I'm going to go with Blade Runner.
Going to go with Blade Runner, and with that, everybody is on the board. Jason with 2 points, Harry and Aaron with a point apiece. The correct answer is indeed Blade Runner. Well done.
The thing about that tagline is that there's also that famous line where Rick Deckard said, like, if there's something, then it's not my problem. So like that even gives it more provenance, so to speak.
Or the even more famous line where he's like, ah, fuck. So that's it, huh? I'm some kind of Blade Runner?
In the end, we was always Blade Runners.
Something else that really makes you think is a thing.
In space, blade can do you wrong.
Wow, you're just giving up the game for the third tagline. No, the third tagline is as follows. Everyone wants a cut. Your options there. Option A, all the money in the world. Option B, Gladiator. Option C, The Last Duel. So first guess going to come from Harry.
What if it was Gladiator, dude? That would rule. I'm going to go with all the money in the world, though.
Harry's going with all the money in the world. Now, if you could pick a movie on that list. It never gets old. Aaron, what is your pick for this one?
There's no way it's The Last Duel, I don't think. But everybody wants a cut. That's incredible.
It's so good. It would rule.
I don't think
so
it matches
good.
The gravity of the film, maybe. I'm going to go with the first one.
Yeah, for The Last Duel, it would be like, everyone wants a cut, .. Or do they?
Of the truth.
And what is Jason's truth for this question? You also going all the money in the world, or a different pick?
I like the idea that you're making this, like, I'm just going to say all the money in the world. I can't risk, like, losing Cody.
Well, you're up one, so as long as you just match all of our guesses for the rest of
have some fun, and then we'll go all out together.
This is what I was trying to get at. I think maybe Cody he's got enough of these that he's like trying to shape politically. He's trying to behind the scenes. He's trying to get you guys aligned against so that you can tank yourselves. And I don't know. We'll see.
You know, I did just think though that like game theory wise, like if Jason goes last and Aaron and I picked the same 2. There's absolutely no reason he wouldn't choose the same one that me and Aaron had chosen. It wouldn't make any sense.
So all the money in the world for Jason, is that? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. A point to each of you. Everybody's got at least 2 points, except for Jason, who's got 3.
More like all the points on the board.
Well, I don't know. Not all the points. Y'all didn't get the first question entirely right, all of you.
No,
so some points were
missed. Yeah, I know. I was talking about Jason.
Oh. Well, look at that. Listen, I didn't expect such glad handing at this stage in the game. That's very, very cool of you,
gonna
Harry.
I'm going to get him anyway. He's going to choke. Look at him. He's going to choke.
And the shoe is dropped. We've got 2 more taglines to go. Still extremely much anybody's game. As you can tell, the fourth tagline is as follows. The untold story behind the legend. And your options are option A, Napoleon. Option B, Prometheus. Option C, Robin Hood. So those are your options. And the first guess is going to come from Aaron. What Ridley Scott movie does that tagline belong to?
I think Robin Hood.
Aaron is going Robin Hood. And the next guess is going to come from not Aaron.
I'm
going to
guess Robin Hood. Oh.
It's going to come from Jason. Jason, what's your pick?
It'd be really funny if it was Napoleon, because every part of that story has been told many times. So to call it the untold, like, it would be just a very funny tagline. I don't think it's Napoleon. I do think that it is Robin.
Gotcha.
Just fucking, you know, guess something else.
You can't guess something else, you fucking jackass.
Fucking dick.
Also, Jason, everybody here has seen Napoleon. You don't have to give it away like that.
You're just game theory, little bitch.
Ivory tower, ivory chairs. Just
it's like, not what ivory tower
swimming, swimming in Cody's nobody's wins, and I've got like
things have for meanings, all right, Jason. You don't just get to use words whatever you feel like.
Your ivory chairs. Who has an ivory chair?
Cracking them open. You're sitting
Harry,
down.
What's your guess?
I'm thinking it's Robin Hood. Yeah.
You fuckers just had to talk about Robin Hood and literally call it the untold. That really.
I did give away that whole thing. I'm sorry, Cody. I was really fucking you up.
It doesn't come up often. One out of every, like, I don't know, 80 opportunities.
Do you remember that Oscar Isaac is in that movie, dude? Isn't that crazy?
Fuck, I gotta watch. We do gotta wrap this up. We have one more tagline. This is the fifth and final tagline. It reads as follows: failure is not an option. And your three Ridley Scott film choices are option A, Black Hawk Down, option B, G.I. Jane, option C, The Martian. Those are your three Ridley Scott film picks. The first guess is going to come from Harry, who's looking very confident. Harry, what's your pick?
Black Hawk Down, please, Cody. Thank you.
Harry's doing Black Hawk Down, locking you in. And over to our next fella. And that fella is, God, it sent me right back
to
Harry.
I'm
going to
do Black Hawk Down, Cody. Thank you.
God, man,
I'm going
to
do Black Hawk Down,
this
Cody.
Scanner,
thank you.
The spinner, rather, is broken. Jason is the next guest. Jason, what's your pick?
I'm going to guess G.I. Jane.
Jason is going to guess G.I. Jane.
Honorable. And
Aaron, final guess of the game. What you thinking?
I'm doing The Martian. I believe it is The Martian. I believe that is it.
A man's got to believe in something.
I thought Bring Him Home was The Martian's tagline, pretty famously. Did it have multiple taglines?
Movies can have more than one tagline.
Yeah, I think it could have.
They can, but I thought Bring Him Home was just in the back of the poster.
But not the tagline.
Ooh, now you got me second guessing.
Yeah, you don't get second guesses.
I'm covering the spread anyway. I'm going with God.
Go back to some other game that I don't have the brain power. We clown in this motherfucker. This
wow, what a good slam, Jason. Well done.
Yeah, fucking got his ass.
It's all he deserves.
Going with God, happy Easter, everyone. Failure is not an option is a tagline for G.I. Jane. Jason Whoa. Went 5-for-5, while the other fellas went 3. For a second, I was like, oh, well, the soundboard's coming through now. I was like, no, that was Aaron actually live yelling. Thank you. This has been Spot the Scott. Well played by everybody. Some very genuinely fun game theory this time around. And I'm glad me
orchestrating these.
What is even the
She's
mission?
In fucking boot camp.
What is success?
Yeah,
what does success mean?
Sexism in the fucking military. Like, who gives a shit?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Quick show. Did any of us here see G.I. Jane?
Watched TV ever? Yes, I've seen G.I. Jane. What are you talking
about? Who is the eponymous, the titular character in G.I. Jane?
Okay, so Aaron hasn't seen it in a meaningful
way.
It's
Demi Moore.
Oh, yeah, I fucking watched reruns of it
Demi
in the background
Moore.
While I was with my
no,
brothers.
No, I've seen it on TV. It's a 1997 film. It's been years, yes.
I heard you clickety-clack, and congratulations. You
That's right.
Jason, I believe the POP is yours. Sorry for the delay.
I'm a humble man. Pretty level-headed. Well played, all, you know? By the rules of single combat, your lives are now mine. You are honor bound to me. And I expect you to remain quiet when you see me in public. I expect no interaction whatsoever. I am a ghost to you as you are to me. That's all I got to say. Thank you for losing. Thank you so much, Cody, for structuring another riveting edition of Cody's Noties. I'm glad we had it again. I mean, it does follow our favorite segment, To All the Loves I've Tried.
Listen, buddy, don't ruin this. If I sense any sarcasm, we're bringing that right back.
We are careful here on Try Love. Thank you so much, Cody. And thanks to my friends for showing up for another episode. We have a bunch of episodes in the queue. You should go back and find one that is on a movie that you've covered before. I'm trying to hastily scroll up because there was a piece on Perisphere you should read about this. It's called Harvey the Haughty Hussar by Alex Keese for, and I hope I'm pronouncing Alex's last name, Alex Keese for Perisphere, the Trilon blog that's edited by our good friend and former guest Finn Odom. It's the Perisphere, the Trilon's blog. It accompanies a whole lot of the showings there. There's a lot of really cool writing there. I don't think you need to be in Minneapolis. I don't think you need to have gone to the Trilon to write for it. They are looking for new contributors. So if you like to write about movies, get in touch with them. We've got links various places and on Twitter. I'll put one in the show notes as well. But yes, just as a quick CTA that if you like writing about movies, if you like listening to other people talk about movies, if you like watching movies and writing about them later on, check out Perisphere as a good place to submit some thoughts. But until you do that, you should listen to our outro, which goes a little bit like this. Thank you so much for listening to Trilove. You can find us on Twitter at Trilove Podcast. You can find the Trilon at Trilon Cinema and at Trilon.org. My name is Jason. I help make this show, and I really hope you'll find me on Twitter at Nintendoofus.
I hope you find him too. I've been Cody Narvison. You can find me on Blue Sky at Cody Narvison and on Twitter at Cody_BH.
I've been Harry Mackin. You can find me on Twitter at Punishtake.
My name is Aaron. Find me on Twitter at Army Please.
We'll need to work pretty sharp. Police surveillance. They keep us bottled up at Vatan. Damn their eyes. Slip out, slip back. No one the wiser. Risky, of course, but honor before everything.